keep asking. Yeah, you beat me to it. I was just thinking, I'm annoyed that in every intro I first ask, have you met this person before? So I was trying to think of some other question. Oh, here we go. Have you ever shared breakfast with Ed Skoog?
Shared breakfast? No.
It's something you do with friends. You get breakfast.
Do you? People, I think, get brunch in this town.
Oh, I'm not part of that group.
But nor have I shared brunch with Ed Skoog. I've only done trivia with... I've shared dinner. I've done pub trivia, pub quiz with Ed Skoog. Ed Skoog is a bulwark. How do you say it? He's a bulwark of the basement pub trivia quiz team. Why are you laughing?
No, that was good.
He's a very smart, erudite person.
But what was the other word you said?
Bulwark.
Oh, that's interesting.
College fool.
Yeah, good. I really enjoyed listening to Ed. He seems, you know, there's people that can talk forever, and he is one of those people, but I mean that in the best way.
Because they have things to talk about.
Yeah, it's wildly interesting. And he's so knowledgeable, and I admire that with anyone that can carry that kind of knowledge around and pull it out so easily, because I either have really unexplained large gaps in my knowledge, or for some reason I freeze up and can't reach
the
knowledge.
Yeah, and I do that. I mean, I think I know a decent amount, but if you ask me, I won't be like, I like Nirvana. Like, I get, yes. We asked him questions, obviously, but he was very on point, let's say.
Yeah. Anything else you want to say?
He plays banjo. He's very talented. He's good at pub quiz. I like his poems. Just here in front of me, we talked about Agrippa stuff, mostly New Orleans. Actually, this interview was really interesting because I know him as a Pacific Northwest kind of writer, and he lived in Seattle before he moved to Portland. But before that, he was in New Orleans for like a decade. So what I thought was really interesting about this interview is talking about New Orleans kind of music, blues, jazz, and how kind of ingrained in that culture and in that era, maybe not era, but in how when he was in New Orleans, how much of a fixture of that scene he was.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite parts too.
So. Cool. Good talk. Without further ado, Ed Skoog.
Really? All right. I guess so. Welcome to the Steer. Is that good?
Yeah, that's good. That's really kind of like
a good intonation.
Well, I don't mean on the air, but I just mean in general because, well, whatever. Yeah, it's good.
You know.
Now, do you listen to a lot of podcasts?
I've got a roster that I listen to, you know, during the week. Just mostly is, you know, background noise at this point, you know.
Oh, really? Because you're doing other things?
Yeah, I just do the laundry. You know, I've got one for doing the laundry, got one for chores. I'll give anything a listen, but I just like to hear people talking.
There's something comforting about that.
Yeah. I don't like so much hearing people like read things that they've written. There's a few that I listen to that I like them because they're okay, but it's not really talking. It's sort of, you know, speaking.
So do you mean...
I like people hearing people talk off the top of their heads. The intelligence that comes from some feeling like it's face-to-face conversation.
Well, I've been to readings where someone starts reading something and they're reading from their phone and their phone dies and suddenly they have to tell it from their head and we're all instantly more captivated.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I wish we could learn to read that way, but it might be impossible because the way your brain makes the connection.
It's hard to remember. I think for, you know, fiction writers or poets, it's hard to read off book because you don't remember the choices you made, right? Right. You know, probably you edited it a lot and you can't remember how you finally decided to phrase something, right. You know. People are often surprised why poets don't read, you know, from memory more often.
Right.
Because it's really impressive when somebody does.
Sure.
But I think it's because you don't.
Yeah.
You know, you change this. You know, this is the 15th draft. You know,
right.
I think what you remember is the original poem.
Sure.
And the original spark. And you can, you know, kind of talk about that, but mm-hmm. It's not the same as.
Do you have any poems memorized, either yours or others?
Or I have a lot of other people's poems memorized.
But not.
Did Dylan Thomas memorize his own poems? Or was that, do you know?
He would read, I think he would read from memory.
He would?
Yeah.
Okay.
I got a record of his, and I love that.
I have a record of his.
Yeah,
his
you do too. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I like Richard Burton's readings of his.
Yeah, that's better. The other one.
They don't sound that different, you know?
Yeah, but the thing about a trained actor is really, you can feel it.
Yeah. Hugo would read from memory.
Oh, really?
Richard Hugo. I think that was a lot of why he was memorable to his contemporaries. Was because he read a lot and he would read from memory.
Mm-hmm.
The earliest author reading was Herodotus. I was looking at this.
Okay.
Trying to figure out like why readings are the way they are.
And how?
And I assumed it was kind of a contemporary thing, just purely a kind of a commercial thing. But this, some scholar went back and said, the first actual, apparently like somebody reading from there. Not that he was publishing books. I mean, he had manuscripts, but. You couldn't go to the store and buy. I don't know. Maybe you could.
Well, Herodotus was 13th century. I mean, when was he around?
200.
200. So this is post Plutarch.
Pre-printing. Yeah.
Okay. Huh. Yeah. And somebody kind of.
He would read. He would read.
He would read from his work
Okay. For an audience for money, I suppose.
I was actually curious how much they know about the actual setting. So it was paid admission.
Paid admission to an amphitheater where they would read.
Oh, an amphitheater. Yeah. I mean, I guess he's a big deal. Yeah. I guess he's outdoors, a big deal then, too. So you're from Kansas.
Yeah, are we recording?
Yeah.
I assume so.
Topeka.
Topeka, Kansas.
Topeka, Kansas.
The capital city.
And then you, you lived there until you're 18 or when?
I went to college at 17. Yeah.
Okay.
But I stayed close. I went to Kansas State University, which is just 60 miles away. And stayed there.
And then what did your parents do?
My father was a lawyer.
Okay.
An attorney. He's still around. He's in his late 80s.
Mm-hmm.
Retired for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
He was a geologist to start with.
Oh, that's a change.
It was a change. Yeah. Well, my grandfather was a big part of the highway construction in Kansas. Self-taught civil engineer.
Your grandfather.
My grandfather. And okay. So my dad went to work for him.
Right.
But by the 40s, he had to go to college to become a civil engineer to build the bridge, and so he went to college and got a civil engineering and geology degree, and worked on building the highway, through Kansas.
Okay.
And then when that was up, his dad said, you can work here the rest of your life, but we're not going to build another highway. I mean, you might build some drainage culverts, but you should think about doing something else because we've done the thing we're going
to
do.
And was he was in his 20s at that point?
So he went to law school there in Topeka.
Okay.
Practiced law. Was in politics.
Okay. And then your mother?
She was in the typing pool at the Pentagon.
Interesting.
Wow.
During the war.
Wow.
During World War II when she was a teenager.
Okay.
Oh, my goodness.
Which she had entirely forgotten about until she turned 65 and started receiving Social Security. And it had like a list of your employment. And she'd forgotten that she'd even done that.
So is it one of those?
That was the bulk of her employment.
Sorry, is it one of those things where for everyone else it sounds so interesting, but for her it was so boring, it's why she forgot?
I don't know if it was. I mean, it's. I think being in the typing pool was probably boring because you're just in a big room full.
It's like in the movies, kind of, right? I mean,
but it was the Pentagon and it was World War II.
Right.
So it was probably interesting.
Sounds like
to some degree. And she was, 17.
Oh, my 18. Goodness.
She went to a year of college and then worked as a secretary in some Merrill Lynch office in D.C., lived with her mother, single mother, and they just lived in D.C. and I think had a little cosmopolitan life in the early 50s, and then she married my dad and moved to Kansas. My grandmother had arranged for my mom to meet with a friend of hers who worked for the Bureau of Indian Affairs. before she moved to Kansas, so that my mother would learn something about like Native life, on the assumption that she was going to the prairie in like 1870, mm-hmm. and that she was going to have to ride horses and like barter for goods with the indigenous people, which was of course not what happened. She moved to Topeka, which was a modern city.
Right. But there was still that
1952,
notion.
1952, I don't think she ever saw a horse.
Right. But your grandmother on your mom's side had that notion.
She was scared to death that she was sending her only and beloved daughter, for whom she had sacrificed everything, out into the past.
Uh-huh.
And that would raise a family of rubes, which is what happened.
Well, God, I don't think that's true.
So we would go back to D.C.
Uh-huh.
For much of the summer, and then my grandmother would hustle us into as many museums, see as many plays, go to as many monuments, you know, cultural
mm-hmm.
things as she could fit into that time period.
When you were an adolescent, I mean, when you're younger.
Yeah, when I was a kid and adolescent, yeah. And that did, and it worked in my case. I mean, that my interest in books and cultural things really does come from those summers in D.C.
Okay, because I was going to ask, lawyer, typist, was there a lot of writing and music around when, or was kind of these isolated trips to D.C. or both? I mean,
my parents kind of stopped listening to music in about 1948.
Okay,
right.
Why?
So 70 years ago.
They just weren't music fans. They would listen to the radio. We'd listen to the opera on Sunday afternoons as we cleaned the house. Listen to the Exxon Mobil opera, Texaco opera.
Okay,
Texaco sponsored.
That's such an oxymoron. It seems like the Texaco opera.
They have the money.
And but other than that, my parents liked when they listened to music. It was big band music.
Okay.
So I mean, I'm familiar with the works of Glenn Miller.
Count Basie, Glenn Miller.
Glenn Macy. Count Basie, that's a little avant-garde for my parents.
Okay, you know. So Glenn Miller, okay. I mean, did you get into that because it was all you knew, or were you, I mean?
I got into jazz.
Okay.
But no, it was not a particularly musical household. It was a book household.
It was.
A bookish. Everyone in my family are book readers. Even, you know, a lot of my aunts and uncles and cousins, folks who didn't go to college or just did various things. Everybody's always, reading a book.
Okay.
Talking about books. Not necessarily the greatest books.
But
books.
Uh-huh.
You know, the library was our church.
Oh.
We lived near the library. And just, the path between our house and the library was well beaten.
So that was kind of instilled in you from a young age.
Yeah.
And yet, do you have siblings?
I have four older brothers.
Oh, so then were they kind of instrumental? I mean, that's a lot.
They were a lot older.
They were a lot older.
My nearest brother in age is 8 years older.
Oh, so
my oldest is 18. So they were more like uncles.
Okay,
but they left behind, a lot of debris of comic books,
mm-hmm.
Doonesbury, and science fiction and fantasy paperbacks from the 60s and 70s, which I loved. Asimov, Heinlein.
Okay.
Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
It was just,
I like Middle Earth.
Very central to my upbringing. And, just all of it, they would read one or two science fiction or fantasy novels a day.
Gosh. Some of my
brothers that they're,
So you were into it?
They're into it. My brother still has a lot of them in Alva, Oklahoma.
Okay.
Shelves and shelves of these. and I liked the books. I like the smell of the books. I think more than anything else, I just love the covers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The covers of mm-hmm. 60s and 70s sci-fi and fantasy.
Sure.
Because this is some of the weirdest things ever created by anybody.
And they were so individual and so clearly hand done.
Yeah, it'd be like a lizard man, like in a triangle. And then there'd be a wizard dwarf behind it, holding like the world in a globe, and right. he's got like a little dragon on his shoulder.
Yeah,
yeah.
And that's a normal,
right?
Just a normal book.
Yeah.
And the book would be called, like, you know, The Forgotten Lotheps of Salmonar or something.
Great stuff. Well, you judge a book by its cover and its title, yeah. And those are both.
Yeah, and it took as long to read as it took to write, you know?
Right.
And did they play any instruments, or any of your brothers writers, or was that...
No, they're not writers.
None of them?
Not really, not musicians. Some of them sang a little bit.
Okay.
My next oldest brother had a little... He DJed parties.
Okay.
Like high school dances.
What kind of...
He had lots of records.
What kind of music was he DJing back then?
It was called Pinnacle Productions, he and a friend.
So it was legit.
Had together, yeah. They had, you know, speakers, and they'd set up at, you know, the Topeka West Auditorium and play a dance. I don't think they got to do the prom, but, you know, like a royalty of courts or something.
Mm-hmm. And they got paid.
And they would get paid. And so we had two big steamer trunks of records, and it was early 80s stuff.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, so it was in excess.
Ew, Michael Hutchinson.
Hutchins.
Hutchins, okay. Somebody corrected me about that before. Michael Hutchins.
A number of other, I think everyone else, a lot of other, the autoerotic asphyxiation death stars.
Depeche Mode.
Is that how they died?
Yeah,
but it'd be Depeche Mode. You got your Joy Division, Blasters,
okay,
Beat Farmers, and Ray Beats.
He's 8 years older than
Devo.
You.
A lot of new wave stuff. A lot of pop. But he was older, yeah.
So were you turned on to some of that at the time?
I was not allowed.
You're not allowed
to open the case and play the records. And so I did all the time.
Okay, that's perfect.
And then I would put the records in the wrong case, and he would find out, and he'd be mad at me.
Oh, really?
But
because you were young, and he was, because when you were eight, when you were 10, he was 18. So they didn't live in the house, I think, a whole lot.
That one did a little bit. He was in high school when I was in middle school.
He was in high school.
He graduated 81. I graduated 89. So I guess he wasn't, but he was around. He went to college pretty near.
Okay. So you don't really come from a musical family per se.
No.
Okay, but you started playing banjo at 15. Is that
15 or 16? Yeah, I took piano lessons, cello. I played tuba.
Oh, so you
I was
did,
playing music.
Okay.
Yeah.
When you were younger.
Yeah.
I mean, so okay, so your parents did, because they wanted cultural values. They kind of did make a point of.
Yeah, and I was not good at sports.
Okay.
And I had to do something, right? Uh-huh.
I mean, was so Topeka, this is the early 80s?
Yeah, this is 80.
Or late 80s?
80s. Yeah, the 80s.
Okay, so sports are paramount. So yeah. But you did all these instruments. I mean, and then how did you gravitate towards banjo? Or were you good at, I mean, were you good at instruments, I kind of assume?
I was okay.
Okay. make that distinction.
Yeah, I was okay. I was like the second chair tuba.
Okay, but that's... more than serviceable. That's okay.
There were two tubas.
Did you really play tuba?
There were two tubas.
Do you still play tuba?
I could play a tuba. I don't own a tuba presently.
Oh.
So, but I mean...
Yeah, you put a tuba in
okay.
my lap.
I might...
a sousaphone around my shoulders and I can...
I might call you. I need a tuba player.
I can do a B-flat scale.
Yeah. You know, can, yeah.
Concert B-flat.
Some arpeggios?
I can arpeggiate.
All right.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Making a deal. I like that.
Yeah, I do love it too.
It's a paid gig, I'll tell you right now.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this is high school that you're playing tuba?
So I picked up the banjo in I worked summers and winters at this place. It wasn't called Steel Fixtures, it was called Delta Designs. And they made cabinets, specialty cabinets for museums. So like archival, kind of real niche.
Uh-huh. Right?
It was a shop, maybe 10 or 15 workers, and I swept floors, did basic stuff. But a lot of the guys who worked there played bluegrass, or, you know, strummed a guitar.
Okay.
And on Fridays after work, sometimes they would kick off a little early, have a cooler of red beers, you know, a mixture of, you know, half tomato juice, half Michelob
sure.
Light, mm-hmm. and... Yeah. And just sit on the loading dock and play a little bit, you know, and I liked that. And so I bought a banjo for $100 from Capital City Pawn and figured out how to tune it. And they kind of, one of the guys there taught me the basics. And I tortured everyone around me for many years. I went to college and played and found a group, you know, a bunch of friends to play with. And gradually got better. It took a while. I didn't take any lessons.
But they were playing bluegrass, I mean, essentially.
They were playing bluegrass.
Okay. And that's, yeah. So I was going to ask why the banjo? I mean, mostly because that's the music they were playing. Why not guitar? Is there a reason you gravitated towards that?
No, it just got in my ears, you know.
Okay.
You know, banjos, it's an unpleasant sound, but once you, if you need it, you need it,
uh-huh.
You know. It's like a lot of other, like, little niche, weird sounds that are kind of off-putting, but then if you, or weird taste, you know.
Mm-hmm.
To some people, cilantro tastes like soap.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And some you can't have a lot of food without
right
cilantro.
Totally. So. Okay.
So a lot of people, they see a banjo and run the other way, but me, I run towards it.
Well,
I run towards banjo.
Banjo's not that reviled. I mean,
well, if you, when I say that, so I play I tried playing a fiddle for a while.
Okay,
I'd go through an airport with a violin case, and people would treat me like I was, you know, a genius.
Oh, really?
Oh, this way, sir. Walk through an airport with a banjo case. You don't get that treatment.
Interested.
Yeah, you are an object of suspicion.
Yeah, you should be sitting.
You're
in the
a problem.
Back.
Yeah, wow. You're a problem. Not a gift. You know. I'm leaving tomorrow to go to fly to Wichita, Kansas, and then I'll go down to. Winfield, which is about an hour away,
okay.
For the 46th annual Walnut Valley Festival, which is called the Winfield Bluegrass Festival,
okay.
Which I've been going to with that group of college friends since 1990.
Gosh.
Almost every year. And we just camp. They've been there for a week, some friends. Okay. And you just go and camp and play pretty much around the clock.
And you will be playing. So
I will be playing.
Okay.
Yeah. So I've been pretty committed to it, and I've learned a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, after 27 years or so, I've gotten okay at it.
Well, no,
but I wasn't for a long time.
Yeah. You know? What's the name of your current group?
Called the Hill Williams.
The Hill Williams.
The Hill Williams.
Okay, because I mean, I saw you play last week.
Yeah,
you were great.
Yeah. It's a good band.
Yeah.
Is bluegrass similar? It's bluegrass, you said?
Yeah.
Is it similar to jazz where you follow changes and trade solos?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an improvisation. I mean, there's a, you know, a core, but it's largely improvisational.
Mm-hmm.
And solo based.
Right.
Yeah. So it's it is similar to jazz.
Well, I mean,
it is a descent from jazz.
Well,
it is influenced by jazz. I mean, it's an attempt to play jazz with acoustic instruments.
Mostly plucked instruments, right?
Well, the banjo's plucked, so it's banjo, mandolin,
mm-hmm.
Guitar, which a flat picked guitar instead of a strummed guitar.
Okay.
Fiddle.
Mm-hmm.
Stand-up bass, sometimes a dobro,
yeah,
mm-hmm.
Instead of a fiddle. Mm-hmm. So that's the standard instrumentation of
sure.
it, which has only been kind of codified since it's a fairly recent music. I mean, the first time something was that you would call bluegrass was performed was in 1948, Bill Monroe and the Bluegrass
Bill Monroe,
Boys.
Okay, yeah.
Although he'd been performing since the 20s, but he had this new lineup and sped it up and. Performed at the Ryman Auditorium, the Grand Ole Opry, such and such, 1948. And that's really the first, from then. It had a golden age of about 10 years.
Hmm.
And it was supplanted by rock, but had some of the same pleasures. I mean, it was fast. You could dance to it. It was kind of a youth. It's hard to imagine that it was youthful. It wasn't considered folksy so much. It was really music of Southern diaspora for work, you know, so a lot of the musicians were from Kentucky, Tennessee, Virginia, but they were playing in Detroit and Chicago and, you know, Rust Belt.
And so you said 1940, it's been around in this kind of iteration for 70 years. So that what we would call bluegrass has been around since 1948?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. I mean, some of the repertoire, some of the songs are earlier.
Right. But you, but Bill Monroe is still kind of omnipresent. I mean, you did how two or three songs?
Yeah, well, he invented it.
Kind he invented of, it, know. Okay. So uh-huh. Yeah. It's like Chuck Berry for rock.
Chuck Berry very often would cite Bill Monroe as one of his big influences. You know, Chuck Berry, growing up in the country, listening to the radio, he was a bluegrass fan.
Oh,
and he was trying. He the signature Chuck Berry guitar sound and riff is consciously trying to do on guitar what Bill Monroe did on mandolin.
Huh, that's an interesting lineage.
The Johnny B. Good riff is a mandolin. That is a Bill Monroe line played on guitar.
That's wild.
Yeah.
Is that that's a well known fact that I just didn't know?
Yeah. Okay.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I didn't know that.
You're a couple months too late to ask Barry directly.
I know.
But you hear it in other places, you know, that in the Street by Big Star.
Okay. So we're gonna want to talk about them. Yeah.
That's a Lester Flatt guitar line.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's Alex Chilton said, you know,
okay.
Just playing some just a bluegrass lick played in.
So you went to Kansas State.
Kansas State University, yeah.
And then you're playing music. Are you writing seriously at this point? Are you
No, I've been writing. So writing poetry since 9.
Oh gosh.
Banjo since 16. So.
But I mean, you were like, when I say seriously, like I didn't start writing seriously until I was probably like 25. At 16, you were kind of reading widely and like trying to do it.
Since I was 9.
Gosh, that's.
And I'm serious.
No,
I mean,
no,
it's weird.
I believe you.
But I mean, I started writing poetry for a number of reasons. But one of them is meeting Michael Ondaatje, the Sri Lankan Canadian mm-hmm. poet and novelist.
Yeah, yeah.
Whose brother-in-law ran the cabinet shop.
Michael Ondaatje's brother-in-law ran the cabinet shop.
Yeah, Skip Dickinson.
Okay, Skip Dickinson.
Ran the cabinet shop.
This is in Topeka.
Topeka, Kansas, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and Skip and Linda's dad had been my dad's law partner.
Okay.
And they've been best pals.
Uh-huh.
And so when we went to Toronto for some lawyer conference in 1980 or 79, we went and visited Michael Ondaatje. And Linda Spaulding, she's a significant novelist as well.
Uh-huh.
But they were kind of, I don't know how old they were, maybe in their 30s, and they were kind of hippies. And we went to the house, and it was, or townhouse, whatever it was.
And this is in Toronto.
This is Toronto. And there was, you know, there's like fabric on the walls and lots of house plants and macrame. And it was, you know, they're hippies and you know, like, sort of. I mean, that's a silly thing to say, but. I don't know what other word I would have had at the time to describe.
You're 9, yeah.
And Dodgy's, you know, he's especially then, you know, he had a big head of hair and it's this kind of British accent. And kind of, at the time, he was kind of a wild man. Now he's kind of a, you know, gray old eminence, but
mm-hmm.
you know, and if we were in Topeka and saw them on the street, I think we probably would have crossed the street to avoid him.
Okay.
Frankly.
Right, because they're weirdos.
It's one of the hobbies in Topeka is avoiding people who look different.
Avoiding eccentrics. Okay,
this is really the backbone of the city. But at when we went and visited, it was clear that the deference that my parents had to these people, you know, people uh-huh. basically as old as my oldest brothers, and my parents were not deferential.
Oh, really?
you know, they were. Yeah, you know, my dad is rarely deferential.
Okay.
But it's clear that they had a lot of respect, you know, for them. I remember being on the train back to our hotel and just trying to figure it out. It's like, why
were you on eggshells?
And I said, why? I said, well, what do they do? And I said, well, they're writers. It's like, oh, damn, I want to be a writer.
Really?
I want to be like that. I want to be a grown-up who has fun.
Uh-huh.
You know, and if being a writer is how you do that, show me how, you know. And so we had Ondaatje's books and in his collected or an early selected had just come out, which is called A Trick with a Knife I'm Learning to Do, which is like his poems from the 60s, 70s.
A Trick with a Knife I'm Learning to Do. Okay.
And it's kind of, you know, surrealist, you know, kind of counterculture, strange poems. They had a real spirit of rebellion. They were a little erotic. You know, they're political and all these things that, you know, daily life in Topeka is not very erotic or or if to what degree it's political, it's not oriented towards, you know, matters of justice.
Sure.
You know, post-colonialism. So I was trying to figure out his poems and just trying to wrap my head around him, made me want to write. And so I started writing and reading, and then just sort of following that trail. You know, well, what did he reference, and that led me to William, you know, William Carlos Williams and Charles Olson.
Okay. When you're like 14, people.
I thought it was nine.
Yeah. Well, nine. Yeah. Well, earlier.
Yeah.
Really.
I mean, yeah. The Charles Olson. I mean, that's at a young age.
It was Olson at nine, but pretty early.
Right. I'm curious. Did this remain for a long time a solitary pursuit, or did you have any friends that were also into it?
There were a surprising number of the people I grew up with have become poets of distinction.
Yeah, I mean,
it's true.
No, I know. Will you name a couple? I mean, I think I know, but
Kevin Young, Ben Lerner.
Okay,
Nick Twemlow.
Ann
Boyer. I didn't know C.A. Conrad or Michael Robbins, but they were in town.
This is Kansas generally,
this
not
Topeka.
Topeka specifically.
This is my neighborhood.
Okay. Gosh.
Ben Lerner and Nick Twemlow is a poet that you should know.
I know. I lived with him last month.
They lived in the same house.
Gosh, really?
Like Nick moved out and then the Lerners moved in.
Okay.
You know?
Uh-huh.
But we didn't talk about poetry.
No.
We had some of the same teachers. We talked to each other. You know, we knew each other. We were kind of smart and bookish. We probably talked about books and poems. Everyone was writing something, but I don't remember ever talking about it. We did with Kevin, because we had like some outreach creative writing class in like middle school or something. But no, we're more into like speech and debate. So it was language. It wouldn't have been appropriate to talk too much about the poetry you were writing.
Why not?
In Topeka, Kansas in 1985 or 6 or 7.
Because it would be mocked?
You'd be mocked.
Even though you knew these people might be doing the same thing, it was still kind of...
Yeah, we had other things to talk about. We were just teenagers, you know?
Right. But you guys were all in the same school system, even if you didn't go to the same school? Okay. Gosh, that's wild.
Yeah, not all the same. I mean, Ben's a little younger.
Yeah.
5 or 6 years younger.
Okay.
Kevin's a year older.
Still, I mean,
but yeah, it wasn't. It's not like, you know, we all are acquainted with each other as adults, but it's not like we're on a group chat or anything.
Sure.
You know,
but I mean, if you saw Kevin Young walking down the street, I mean, you would definitely say something.
I would say hi.
You wouldn't go back to your Topeka roots and cross the street to
no, 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 no. I love all those guys and gals and poets, and I like their poetry a lot. But there's no. It is merely coincidence,
right?
Aaron Kunyan,
is
one of the smartest people alive.
Okay,
he wrote an essay. The essay is mostly about like the phenomenon of like cultural districts and like how cities and institutions try to create creativity, mostly for, you know, economic purposes, right? To create an arts district, or, you know, the 1% for the arts, or try to take the edge off capitalism by having there be something to do.
Sure.
Kind of like that Ishiguro novel about the arts. It's like it's basically a farm for harvesting clones' organs.
Oh yeah, I read Never
Let Me Go.
Let Me Go, yeah.
But that's what it is. It's a farm for harvesting organs, but it's really an arts high school.
Okay.
And they're trying to let the clones self-actualize before they're, you know, cut up into kidneys and livers.
It's powerful.
Yeah.
The book is?
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
That analogy.
Yeah. Well, I was referring to the book, but it was a good analogy. Great,
yeah. So Kunyan, on one hand, he talks about that. Like, here's, you know, here's
and
all
he's
these.
From Topeka, too.
No, he's not from Topeka.
But he's
just
okay.
perplexed why all these poets are from Topeka.
Sure.
And then he says, but on the other hand, you have all these poets from Topeka and other artists. And he says, and this is a place that, you know, he does a little research. He's like, it's fair to say that it was hostile to the arts. There was no 1% for the arts, you know, right. in Topeka. You know, there's no cultural, there's no arts district, no, you know. And yet, you know, there's 10 or 15.
Significant.
You know, an interesting, some surprise, an unpredictable per capita
mm-hmm.
poetic output.
I'm wondering if you can remember, was there just a feeling of calm and serenity that maybe made it easier for kids to explore that stuff?
No, it's not. It was an antagonistic
oh.
culture. Yeah, wow. yeah. You had you know, a lot of evangelical Christianity
wow.
Being pushed at you. A lot of you know, that, and the Phelps, the Westboro Baptist Church, Fred Phelps,
okay.
the group that okay, you know, so God then, hates fags oh, and yes, protesting, okay. you know, military funerals and anything. Oh yeah, oh. Same high school. That's those kids were in our
wow.
oh, damn.
Debate classes okay. as well.
Did not know that.
Yeah, so I mean, that's the environment.
Wow, was your was family religious?
Intensely repressive, homophobic culture,
wow.
for which you know signs of being in the arts was a reason of suspicion.
Oh, that's kind of you know. Okay, huh?
Yeah.
Were you raised religious at all?
No,
just okay.
Library. Congregational. If somebody died, you'd be buried in a congregational. You have a congregational service, but that was the only connection I had to it.
Uh-huh.
My father started going more after my mom died. My mom was she would say that she was too proper. She was concerned about her respectability, having grown up in kind of difficult circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
So she wouldn't, you know, say that she was an atheist, but she would say, I don't believe in magic.
Mm, that's great. I don't believe in magic.
Yeah.
So from 9, you were kind of set on being a writer.
I really was.
And yeah. then banjo happens 15, 16.
Yeah. But that's, I mean, I spent a lot of time with the banjo and I love it, but it's,
but it was never something that you were
it's
like,
it's still a secondary or you know, tertiary thing,
but you're also very good at it and you take time to play with people and I assume you practice sometimes. I mean,
oh, we practice once a week. I perform, you know, once or twice yeah. a week. I make more money playing banjo than I do writing poetry.
Okay.
But it's
a secondary. Okay.
It's another little It's just a little. It's a mm-hmm. side hustle. Is that what they call it?
That's what the kids call it. Side hustle.
Yeah.
When I'm gonna probably pronounce this wrong. When did you first hear? Is it Ernie K. Doe?
Ernie K. Doe.
Thank you.
Yeah, Ernie K. Doe. Well, you hear him early. But I probably first heard him on like Dr. Demento or something, mm-hmm. because Mother-in-Law is a novelty song.
Okay.
The first time I really. He became a fixture in my mind, I suppose, was when I moved to New Orleans in 1998.
Yeah, I was going to ask.
Six or eight, yeah.
Kansas State, and then you made your way to New Orleans.
Grad school in Montana.
Grad school in MFA, Montana. Okay.
Worked at Microsoft briefly in mm-hmm. Seattle. And then my now wife and I moved to New Orleans.
Okay.
Where we lived for almost a decade. I got a job at the art museum.
Yes. So Ed Skug, who worked for years in the basement of a museum in New Orleans, developed personal connections to the collection's art objects and paintings.
I didn't write that.
Is that accurate? No, I'm not saying. I'm just saying. Okay, so you were in New Orleans.
It's like I was making out with the statues.
I'm
or something.
Not. I'm reading the jacket copy. It makes complete sense.
It's a personal connection.
It's a personal connection.
You were there for a decade, though. You're in
well,
New Orleans.
Well, yeah, it was 8.5 years. 8.5 years.
Okay.
But during the good years, like the best of one's 20s and 30s.
So I'm not that familiar with Ernie K. Doe. You shared that clip of him talking on the radio, which is just beautiful to listen to. Did you hear him talking first, or you heard his music first?
Well, so his you know his hit it was number one hit in the country in 1961, 10 years before I was born. It was mm-hmm. Mother-in-Law, written and produced by Alan Toussaint.
Mm-hmm.
And you know the song, right? Mother-in-law.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mother-in-law.
Right.
We'll link to it on our thingy.
I might play it in a second.
Okay.
So I moved to New Orleans, and I was some friends who had moved down there before me said that they'd been hanging out at his bar. And so I went there a few times. But then my neighborhood was the Bywater, which is downriver from the French Quarter. The museum was in City Park, and it was, you know, 2 or 3 miles. And they were doing road construction one summer, very hot summer. And so it set me on this detour through the 7th Ward. And I found myself every day going by Ernie Cato's mother-in-law lounge, which is on Claiborne Avenue. Mm-hmm. And so I started stopping in after work for a beer. And Cato was always there. It was Ernie Cato's mother-in-law lounge. He had bought it, and he lived there. He and his wife, Miss Antoinette, lived in the back and upstairs. And he would always be there. So you would go in and, you know, get a beer. You know, the TV was on. And Cato would get up off the couch in the back, put on his wig, put on his cape, and come out and let you buy him a Hennessy and would talk.
So this is in the late 90s, early aughts.
Yeah.
And he's a Memphis R&B legend.
R&B legend. New Orleans R&B
New
legend.
New Orleans R&B. Sorry.
And had this little bar, and you could just go talk to him. And he loved to talk because he was one of the greatest talkers of all time.
Let me see if I can get this.
Two greatest talkers I've ever known. Ernie Cato and Seattle journalist Rich Smith.
Okay.
Greatest speakers. Greatest talkers.
On different radio stations.
And you.
I respect them from coast to coast. But one thing that I have that they do not have, my rap is strong and my love is long. Oh my goodness gracious. I don't know about y'all out there this evening, but I feel it. They can learn from me. Some people called me up one time and asked me, say, Bernie Cato. Burn Cato Bun. Say, why do you talk? And I told the ladies and I told the young men. I say, why don't y'all get on long distance and ask Bob Barker? Why don't you ask Dick Clark? Then again, Gabriel Heater is dead. Why don't you ask him? Why did they talk? You see, talking makes a radio station. Talking makes a TV station. Do you think Bob Barker would be on television as long as he is now if he couldn't talk? You must talk.
You must talk.
There ain't nobody know nothing about no WWOZ radio station before I come on here. But I'm here today. I'm here today. And all other radio stations got to put up with me. Ain't nothing they can do. Ain't nothing they can say. I am what I am the greatest. Number one, number one, number one in this city of New Orleans. And by none, any disc jockeys think that they can beat me. Tell them to pull off their socks and shoes and we walk to the foot of the Mississippi River and wade together. Let's see who come out. Back off of me! I'm so good, I got to paint myself in the morning, see if I'm still alive. Burn Kato, boy!
That's amazing. Did he talk like that in person?
Oh, a little bit, yeah. I mean, that was his radio. So he had a radio show on WWOZ, which was like KBOO for New Orleans, mm-hmm. For a while. And he would talk, he would play music, and he would, you know, talk to people. But he would also just go on 20, 30 minute sermons, you know. And he was relentlessly aphoristic, and he was brilliant.
Relentlessly aphoristic.
Would, you know, create sayings.
Okay.
On the fly, and he had lots of weird ideas, and he had lots of strange facts some of them true, all of them true. He was gave himself the name the Emperor of the World.
The Emperor of the World.
But then he part of one of his things was he says he's not sure, but he's pretty sure that all music came from New Orleans.
Okay.
That's what he says, which is a good argument for it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that he was the Emperor of the World, but then he later revised that he was the Emperor of the Universe.
Oh.
Yeah, why go small?
Yeah, he did not go small. Yeah. Burn, Cato, burn.
Yeah.
Her name was Cador, Ernest Cador, K-A-D-O-R-E, Ernest Cador Jr., born in rural Louisiana, 41. Mm-hmm. Came to the city and started recording pretty young for Alan Toussaint. Most kind of as a second or third guy. Lee Dorsey was really his main, was his best, was the, kind of the best voice in the Toussaint studio. So like working in a coal mine.
Mm-hmm.
Number of, you know, others, other hits. And Lee Dorsey was great.
Right.
Lee Dorsey also ran an auto body shop and didn't like to travel.
Okay.
Although he lived out here for a while. Lee Dorsey was a boxer in Portland.
Really?
In the 40s, went by the name Kid Chocolate.
Oh, did not know that.
Then went back and had an auto body shop. So he liked to record, but didn't like to travel and perform. Cato was not as great a singer and not as great in the studio, but he loved to perform. And he had a James Brown type, mm-hmm. you know, on stage, better than James Brown, mm-hmm. you know. So he had a few hits. Recorded some great things that were. Mother-in-Law was a big national hit, and some other great songs that were just kind of regional hits, like Here Come the Girls, mm-hmm. and A Certain Girl, which is a great one, and a number of other good ones. And then he kind of fell into 20 years of alcoholism and drug use and.
You know, in New Orleans, he was always
in New Orleans or you know, wherever he was. You know, okay. He was really he got addicted to. And he talked openly about it. You know, he was addicted to crack, cocaine, mm-hmm. and was rarely performing. You know, he went from sharing the stage with Elvis Presley, who he said was the greatest rock and roll drummer.
And roll drummer.
Yeah, he had a whole bit about, and the greatest singer was Roy Orbison.
Okay. What was his bit on? Did Elvis play drums on occasion?
I guess he would play drums once in a while.
Okay. Interesting.
Or someone who looked like Elvis played drums. I mean, Cato's memory was very accurate.
Yeah, yeah.
But fantastic. And then he was rescued by love, Antoinette, who's from some other New Orleans musical families. I think I think she's sister of or cousin of the women, some of the women in the Dixie Cups,
mm-hmm.
And other things. And so she kind of got him set up and squared away financially because he had a lot of money owed to him that just wasn't coming to him. So she kind of got him arranged so that he had an income, income that was coming to him, and got his health, you know, got him some health care, you know, mm-hmm. got him kind of, you know, off got him in recovery,
mm-hmm.
and they used the money and they opened this little club, Ernie Cato's Mother-in-Law Lounge, after he kind of got back on his feet, started doing radio work, and he would perform for anything in town. You had a fundraiser for your elementary school, Ernie Cato was there. He did not say no.
Okay.
All right. He'd like to make money. You know, he'd play for money. He'd play the jazz festival and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But mostly he would just play for anything.
Did he like to play? He was a born performer.
He loved people.
Okay.
He liked to talk. He liked to meet people. He was a real deal. You know, I'd go in there, you know, white guy from Kansas, dumbass, you know, and I'd go in and you know, talk to him. And he had his bits and he liked to talk, but he would listen.
He wasn't just
talking to talk.
And I mean, that's a key thing.
He loved
thing.
People. He was a very active listener. You know,
some people are just talkers and they don't listen.
No, he wanted to know everybody's stories. He's a loving guy. Great force. Hmm. And it turns out he was dying.
Gosh.
Right. You know, so as often the case, you know, you get in recovery, you get squared away, and then you get leukemia or something. Right. I think he had leukemia. And he was dying. And so he would always say yes to anything. He played. you know, all over town, all over the region for anything. So that when he died, 2003 maybe, 2002, 3 or 4,
mm-hmm.
just before the storm, it was the biggest funeral New Orleans has ever seen.
Really?
He lay in state at Gallier Hall, which is like the city hall, the old city hall, ceremonial city hall downtown. Lay in state, had a big service, and there were 15,000 people
wow.
accompanying him from the service to a tomb
mm-hmm.
that someone had donated in one of the old cemeteries there by the quarter,
okay.
in the Treme. Charity yeah. hospital baby, you know, and had the biggest celebration, biggest outpouring of love I've ever seen. Because
mm-hmm.
I was there.
I was gonna say you went,
there.
Yeah.
I was there. Me and my friend T.R. Johnson put on our seersucker suits and went down
uh-huh.
And walked along with the caisson, whatever you call it, the horse drawn carriage.
Okay, we
you know
had the wrong people to ask, but yeah.
like they carried JFK, you
mm-hmm.
know,
okay,
mm-hmm.
The funeral cortege, mm-hmm.
right.
And had you know the brass band, you know, the full New Orleans funeral, and 15,000 people
Gosh.
Walking.
Well, that's
you know,
what, I mean, it's hard to wrap your
dancing,
head around
dancing on cars, dancing on rooftops, dancing on walls.
Uh-huh.
I mean, just the joyous love and sorrow and grief take him over there, and I think that's what he was planning. Like that was this payoff,
mm-hmm.
you know. Sure. So moving and a great performer, all the way to the end. Got to see him a number of times.
Sure,
it was hard to avoid him.
Because he was
late
so,
'90s and early.
Right. Early yeah. So we emailed you. I mean, you said Ernie Cato, James Booker, Aaron Neville, Irma Thomas, Dixie Cups. Al Carnival Time Johnson, Earl yeah. King. I mean, did you know New Orleans R&B before you got down there? Did you just get immersed in it?
I got immersed in it down there.
Okay. So wasn't it really on? Because
a lot of the performers were still alive, partly because they, even though they were born in the 30s or 40s, 20s, a lot of they recorded really young. You
right.
know, they were recording, you know, a lot of their hits, you know, as teenagers. And so they were still around. I mean, Fats Domino just died last year, you know,
yeah.
earlier this year.
And they stayed there. They stayed there.
And they stayed there by and large.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, they stayed there. And so they were part of the community. They were the community, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I knew some of the music before going down there from soundtracks or things. You know,
right.
some hits, you know, reached nationally. But there was it's just a regional jukebox that's very different. And... You know, I think of the Holy Grail for a poet,
mm-hmm.
an artist, is something that meets your most rigorous aesthetic curiosity and demands, right?
Okay.
And people might understand, you know.
Okay.
Those things are often, you know.
Separate.
The Holy Grail, you know, the point of the Holy Grail is it's inaccessible, right? You know, even the pure at heart, you know.
So
can't
meets
get
your
it.
Most. Can you say that? Just
meets your most rigorous aesthetic.
Meets your most.
You know.
Rigorous.
You know. For your demands as an artist, both from, you know, your practice and
mm-hmm.
your understanding and your education and your instincts and your
curiosity.
Impulses and curiosity, like you know the thing is like there's nothing phony or BS about this. This is, you know, this is an authentic aesthetic
mm-hmm.
object. And that is accessible, right?
Yeah.
You can make something that's aesthetically rigorous and has very little weight in the world,
right.
mm-hmm.
which is fine. I mean, between the two, I prefer that, right? Because that's what matters.
Right.
And this, you can make something that's I don't like the word accessible, but it's accessible, that like somebody can listen to and appreciate and brings them some joy or, you know, amusement or something. You can make that without it having any real substance.
Sure.
But if you can get there in the middle, you know,
mm-hmm.
not by compromising nothing.
Right.
Right. That's the Holy Grail.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Be able to do both of those.
Mm-hmm.
Make something that that is the deepest expression of your heart and mind, and that somebody encountering it will have a similar feeling. You know,
mm-hmm. It's interesting because it would kind of, as you're encountering it, it would pull you in two ways where you're like, wow, this is satisfying my deepest weird personal curiosity, but it's also so easy to love. This is confusing that I have both.
I know, right?
So a lot of this hard to do too.
It's hard to do. Well, it's impossible.
Right.
It's impossible.
But it's the goal.
It's the Holy Grail.
Yeah. It's the Holy Grail.
There is no Holy Grail. You know.
Okay. Yeah.
So a lot of this New Orleans R&B, I think, is like that Holy mm-hmm. Grail, right? I mean, it's it really is. These are great musicians, and it's great music. So a lot of the musicians playing with Toussaint at C Saint Studios and Minute Records and playing for the producers Cosimo Matassa and Wardell Cruzer and these great producers were some people I worked with at an art school I taught at there. Alvin Batiste Jr., Kid Jordan, Kent Jordan, Bob French, George French, Earl Palmer.
Okay.
Idris Muhammad, who were some of the greatest, like, avant-garde improvisational free jazz musicians that have ever been,
mm-hmm.
right? Especially Alvin Batiste, Idris Muhammad.
Okay. You were teaching them, or they were
no. These guys are like, most of them are gone now, but these are the guys who were the studio musicians.
Okay. So
on these records,
sure,
right?
Sure.
Okay. So they were playing this, you know, Mother-in-Law, playing, you know, piano and drums on Mother-in-Law, or It's Raining, or
mm-hmm.
Ain't Got No Home, by Clarence Frogman Henry. You know, mm-hmm. Ain't Got No Home. Novelty music, partly, uh-huh. you know.
Sure.
But they were, you could put these musicians up against any musicians in the world. And they were the children, you know, granddaughters, grandsons, or they're taught by the people who created jazz in the 1870s, 1880s. I mean, it's direct lineage.
That's wild.
Direct lineage to them, and direct lineage, you know, farther back to Congo Square, mm-hmm. there in New Orleans, which was, you know, where on Sundays, you know, free people of color and enslaved Africans could go, and mm-hmm. you know, depending on the decade, sort of be free to talk about and engage and remember ancestral music and rituals and ceremonies and folkways and
mm-hmm.
and things, as well as being contemporary, which is really where, you know, you can point to the piece of land where a lot of African culture survived in the New World.
Okay.
And these musicians, you know, directly come out of that.
Well, and they were unsung, though, too. A lot of those names, like, people know the Wrecking Crew. People know, like, famous studio musicians. But a lot of these, they were just amazing, but they weren't, outside of New Orleans, super well-known. Or at least I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, some of them would go, some of them would go and be session people in L.A.
Okay.
or New York. Earl Palmer went and created rock and roll drumming.
Mm-hmm.
After leaving New Orleans.
Earl Palmer.
Earl Palmer.
It sounds familiar.
Yeah, Earl Palmer. You've heard him. You hear him every day.
Okay.
And Dave Bartholomew, who was, you know, New Orleans musician and producer, who went out to L.A. and produced, like, the Sonny and Cher show.
Oh.
And things like that. Dr. John, you know, went out.
Okay.
And was a studio musician for all these things.
Sure.
James Booker, great, you know, one-eyed, gay, junkie piano player.
James
was one of the greatest musicians ever to walk the earth.
From New Orleans, or no?
Oh, from New Orleans, yeah.
Gosh,
James Booker.
So, I mean, so many names you've just said. Yeah. It's crazy. I mean,
and he went out to L.A., and he ended up playing, like, I think he plays the piano on, like, Midnight at the Oasis. Midnight at the Oasis. Those little changes on that.
Okay.
You know. But ended up, you know, coming back to New Orleans and trading Harry Connick Sr., piano lessons for Harry Connick Jr. in exchange for, like, leniency on jail time and stuff.
That's wild too.
Harry Connick Jr. is no slouch.
Yeah,
he's a great piano player.
Yeah. Harry Connick Jr.
Harry Connick Jr. is a great piano player.
As a piano player.
Mm.
Have you ever seen him play piano?
Not live. I've heard him.
I guess yeah. I. Yeah. Yeah,
but he was taught by the best.
Well, right.
Did I understand it right? A lot of these studio players, you're saying their thing was really avant-garde experiment, but they did the studio for money?
They did it for money, but they also enjoyed it.
They enjoyed it too.
You know? Okay. They enjoyed it. And they enjoyed having both. So the rigorous, you know, the most rigorously aesthetic jazz musicians. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, like Ornette Coleman, Sun Ra, Chicago Jazz Ensemble, whatever that group was called. Mm-hmm. You know, who really took you know, jazz to, you know, the most difficult places,
right,
and difficult to listen to often.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, but you know, you know, free improvisational jazz done by highly trained, mm-hmm, serious musicians is,
it's amazing.
Is one of the far, it's like the Voyager, you know, spacecraft thing. It's, you know, these are the far reaches of the human body and intellect and heart.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then they'd go in and play, you know, on a Little Richard.
Right.
Record,
that's it sounds so romantic. I'm sure they had hard times, yeah, but it sounds amazing.
They didn't have hard times. A lot of them didn't make a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And after, you know, if you look them up, you'll see, you know, the ones who lived, who are still alive or lived past 2005, you know, it's like, you know, they lived, you know, lived in New Orleans and all this, and then Hurricane Katrina, you know, wiped, right, out everything they owned, and they ended up in Boulder, Colorado or something, yeah, where they died of, you know,
right,
sorrow. Yeah.
Died of sorrow.
Sorrow kills a lot of people, Jeff.
Yeah. I'm not there yet, Ed, but, okay, so I tracked some of the musical references in all your books, and we've been talking about New Orleans R&B, but I mean, in Mr. Skylight, we have you name check Pavement, Slandered and Enchanted, Irma Thomas, James Brown, Graham Parsons, Cat Power, one of the titles of the poems, Punk's Not Dead. I mean, you listen to everything.
Yeah.
I mean, so you have, you know, you have the things that you go to, but all of these, you have a wide au revoir of listening that kind of comes into, at least in this book,
yeah,
you know. Is that something that you like all different types of music, or?
I really do.
And you like all the different types of poetry too, I assume.
Yeah,
too.
I, yeah, do. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I can't, I have trouble focusing. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. When you ask like, what are some things you want to talk about? I was like, well, what do I want to talk about? I could talk about bluegrass. I could talk about,
right,
Prague, you know, I could talk about, like, even within New Orleans, we could talk about bounce music, you know,
sure,
bounce hip hop. From the,
right,
the same period.
Well, that I know,
which,
a little bit more of, yeah,
which is also fantastic.
Is this Graham Parsons antidote in, like, Night Catching Jackrabbits in its barbed wire?
You know the story? You know the story?
No.
You know Graham Parsons, right?
I just know the name.
Okay, so
Flying Burrito,
really,
Brothers. Yeah.
Really rich guy. Rich family. Orange Groves from Florida, right?
Okay.
He goes to Harvard.
Graham Parsons went to Harvard?
Yeah, went to Harvard.
Oh.
And then starts playing, you know, folk music in Boston, drops out, moves to California with his band,
uh-huh,
the International Submarine Band,
yeah, yeah,
which they're not that good. And he's a good guitar player and good singer, and he sort of envisions a hybrid of country and rock, mm-hmm, which is obvious now, but at the time was not really, hmm, a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, plays with the Birds.
Mm-hmm.
Sweethearts of the Rodeo, ends up going over, and there's dispute about how much of Exile on Main Street is whether he actually plays on any of it or whether he co-wrote Wild Horses or some of those songs.
Sweet Virginia.
Yeah. They made him leave because he's also a fantastic drug user.
Yeah.
Really good at it. Really, he discovered Emmylou Harris.
Yeah.
And, you know, performed, recorded, you know, formed a lot with Emmylou Harris,
mm-hmm,
the early years, and you know, records I think 3 solo albums and dies pretty young,
yeah,
out in Joshua Tree, and this is from there's a biography by, I think, Ben Fong Torres,
mm-hmm,
wrote the biography. That's where I get this anecdote from, which was that
he was a Rolling Stone writer back in the day,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Well, want me to read it?
Yeah.
Okay, so. This is where the speaker, it's on the speaker's birthday. We finish our game, the bar closes, and those who are sober go to bed, while those who are left drive to town, Joshua Tree, half an hour through last summer's forest fire.
until we find the saloon by the motel where Graham Parsons died twice in 1973. The first time, his hooker expertly shoved a cube from the ice bucket up his ass, restored him, and yet he knew enough of life to shoot up again. It's hard to save your own life to take such extreme measures alone. And that's true. Yeah. That's it.
Well, according to
Ben Fong Torres,
according to his biographers who spoke with the several women that he was with at the Joshua Tree Motel.
Do you ever get used to hearing other people read your words at you?
Oh, it seems.
Was that bad?
Seems fine. Yeah, it seems nice. It's flattering.
Okay.
I'm not sure that the poems exist unless somebody else says it.
That's true.
New Orleans connection. So Graham Parsons, he dies. It's sort of famous that they steal his body from the tarmac at the LAX, take it back out to Joshua Tree and burn it, you know. But the ashes end up in Louisiana. So his brother-in-law had some misreading of Napoleonic code, because Louisiana follows a different legal code than the rest of the country, Napoleonic code, which is basically the same law, but there are some differences in terms of property and inheritance and divorce and probate issues. Mm-hmm. So we thought that if Parsons' remains were in Louisiana, then the family orange money would flow to his sister and therefore to him. And so he had Parsons' ashes interred at a little cemetery in Metairie, which is one of the suburbs of New Orleans. It was in an unmarked grave for many years. And I don't think it worked. I don't think that the plan to get the Parsons' riches worked, but that's where he was, unmarked grave. And then in the 90s at some point, Emmylou Harris paid to have a modest little marker.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
That's an interesting
Which has his actual name, which is not Graham Parsons, but was it something Ingram or something?
Okay.
And then it says God's Own Singer.
Yeah. I like Grievous Angel. I like Graham Parsons. Yeah. Amen.
So I'd go out there to the cemetery on Memorial Day.
Oh, really?
Because I didn't have any people in Louisiana. It's not where I'm from.
Right.
But I'm an ancestor worshiper. So it seems appropriate on Memorial Day to me to go visit somebody's grave.
Right.
And so for a few years, I'd go out and undertake some. I figured out where it was. Not everybody knew where it was. And of course, everybody loves Graham Parsons. And so we'd go out to the cemetery and leave some flowers.
Oh.
I've got my surrogate here in Portland, even though I don't have any family here. My wife's family is all from here, so we could go to their cemetery, but they don't seem to care that much about cemeteries.
Yeah. That's something, though, that you do? You're an ancestor?
Well, I want to go out to William Maxwell is buried here. You might not know William Maxwell.
I don't know William Maxwell.
He's a novelist. Okay. He was a fiction editor for The New Yorker. 50s, 60s, 70s.
Okay.
But also a magnificent writer.
Uh-huh.
Three novels, mostly about losing his mother to the Spanish influenza epidemic 100 years ago.
Huh.
And so he's buried here because his wife was from here. He doesn't have any people out here. He's buried up, you know, kind of by the Selwood Bridge, that cemetery up above it.
Mm-hmm.
So.
So you go? You've been there a couple times.
I haven't been out there yet, but
it's on your list.
That's my Graham Parsons grave for Portland.
Okay.
Well, cemeteries can just be a wonderful whatever city you're in. It's such a quiet park, more quiet than a park because there's so few.
Yeah, it's people an enforced quiet.
Yeah.
Circumspect.
Yeah, I love them.
You don't find much circumspection in the city.
And there's little stories all around you on every gravestone.
Yeah.
I just want to touch on a couple things in terms of your own work. So Rough Day came out, and then Run the Red Lights came out, and they're very different. And I read that starting your own podcast, I mean, did that kind of have some impact on the changes?
It did. So
is that correct, or am I making
no,
that
it's
up?
True. So okay. Enjoy. So Rough Day, the second book, has its sort of formal principle. I was trying to enact what James Booker does on piano, which is like Bill Monroe or Chuck Berry. It's a virtuosity that's also ragged, right? That is also will go out of time. It'll play a lot of wrong notes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a virtuosity without necessarily precision. You know, which to me, as a stylistic principle, indicates, you know, the skill and the time and the dedication, but also, you know, the flaws
right.
that are inherent in being human, being part of the, you know, the performance and composition. Mm-hmm. So James Booker was like that. James Booker was a great technical piano player and an improviser, and there's also a lot of weird notes
happening.
You know, time would sort of move, and you know, it was not really governed by the metronome.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And it's a syncopated style, you know, sort of New Orleans Caribbean style, sort of like Professor Longhair. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's this tradition of that. And so I tried to create a stanza style that would incorporate that. So I found one. And so the whole book is follows this 3-2-1, 3-2-1, 3-2-1, and then ending
right.
on a couplet, which the poem doesn't really discuss. But for me, what's the analogy for me is the sort of the offbeat playing of James Booker.
Sure.
For my most recent book, hopefully it's not my last, I've got one coming out next year.
Yeah.
For the formal analogy, the formal principle of it is talk.
Right.
And that really became from doing this weekly conversation with my friend J. Robert Lennon, who's a novelist, who's a great talker and who I like talking to. Joshua Beckman gave a really great lecture a few years ago about talking, borrowing heavily from Heinrich von Kleist's essay about talking from the 1800s. Von Kleist was like a German romantic novella writer. Uh-huh. Writes this great essay about talking and how it generates intelligence and friendliness at the same time, and tells us something about how, you know, the whole act of composition, both, you know, talking, mathematical composition, artistic composition, is it's longing for face-to-face conversation. They're all sort of forms of face-to-face communication, of talking, right? Mm-hmm. Even a painting, you know, a portrait is a dialogue. It's a face-to-face, you know, dialogue.
Sure, sure.
And how it, and some speculation as to why. Well, this is some sort of obligation that comes from talking face-to-face, that you don't want to disappoint the person, that, or there's also, you know, maybe something kind of magical and spiritual happening face-to-face. So a lot of poetic analogy for form comes from music and from dance.
Right.
Right. And more modernist, you know, from film or other things. But usually there's always some analogy to some other human activity or art form. And so for this one, I thought, well, I want to get as close to talking as I can. And I'm not the first poet to do that. I mean, of course, very talky poets of the 20th century, Frank O'Hara particularly. But I was just very interested in the prosody of talking. Mm-hmm. What is it? Because, of course, it's just as artificial. I mean, creating a poem that's talky is just as artificial as making one of any other principle.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just thinking about what's the prosody, what sort of choices go into making something feel like talk. Not just recorded talk or ironic, you know, I understand that this isn't talk, I'm pretending it to make it like talk. I wanted it to be as close to actual talk. So some of the poems are actual transcriptions of podcasts.
Oh, really? Yeah. So I was going to, I mean, yeah, but if you hadn't started that podcast, this book would be a lot different.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. And then I got a whole list of musical references you do here, but I just want to do two. Aside from Ghostbusters, the saddest song ever written is Kung Fu Fighting.
Yeah, they're both very sad songs. Don't you think?
Are
you familiar with the songs?
Well, yeah, those songs. When you say Ghostbusters, you mean from the movie?
The theme from Ghostbusters.
Yeah, sure.
By Ray Parker Jr., which he was, of course, lost a lawsuit to Huey Lewis because it's basically I want a new drug. Huey Lewis, I think you told me this, is actually Lou Welch was his godfather.
Okay.
San Francisco poet Lou Welch.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
His godson is Huey Lewis.
Okay, that's interesting. Did not know that.
So Ghostbusters theme is beguiling, and it's very sad because it's about ghosts. So it means it's about death. I mean, the whole Ghostbusters film is about the dead,
right?
You know,
but it's so if it doesn't feel real. I never thought of it as like I'm going to invest a real emotion in this movie.
That's fair.
So, I mean, I enjoyed it wildly. I think Bill Murray is hilarious, but I'm very curious.
Yeah, I don't like the movie that much. You can't watch it with your kids either. You think you can, but you can't because it's actually quite dirty.
Yeah.
But really just isolating the song from the rest of it because I don't know if Ray Parker Jr. ever saw the movie Ghostbusters. The movie has nothing to do with I guess it's a version of a commercial, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. It's a version of a commercial.
Sure.
But he says, you know, is there an invisible man sleeping in your bed? That's very sad, right? Because you understand that it's not on one. Yeah, it's like the invisible man sleeping in your bed. But then it's like, oh, is it as though your partner is invisible or right. you are invisible?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of sorrow and sadness in that. Is there an invisible man sleeping in your bed?
It's because in a lot of ways, we all want to be seen. I never thought of it that way.
We want to be seen. We want to be heard. Madness mm-hmm. is feeling like you're not being heard, mm-hmm. like you're not being seen. That's what, I mean, that's a definition of what insanity is.
Right.
You know, so you add to that the erotic madness, the dead end of, you know, is there an invisible man sleeping in your bed?
Is there, Sonny?
Who are you going to call?
I don't know. Ghostbusters.
Bustin' makes me feel good. but there's something hollow in that, right? What does it mean just to merely feel good in the face of death? Mm. You know, it does not solve death. Fighting is even sadder.
Yeah, I was going to say, what about Kung Fu fighting?
It's all in the past tense.
Okay.
Right?
Everybody
the past tense is inherently
Kung
sad.
Fu fighting.
Nobody is Kung Fu fighting now.
Wow.
Right.
I just to clarify, my son and I are Kung Fu fighting.
Well, yeah, but in the son does not reference you.
Yeah,
your son.
This
yeah,
is pre because
we're invisible.
Yeah. Pre-Blackinger, post Blackinger.
Well, the song, you know, the song is, you know, we hear the song, we say, well, that song's a bit racist. It has that phony pentatonic sort of
trying to do the Asian
scale. Scale, which is not does not approximate it at all. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's phony, but and that's sad.
Right.
Racism
yeah.
is sad.
We broke through in this. Racism is sad.
But also just the past tense of it, right? I mean, it's a poem that's like, you know, the giants have gone.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, those cats were fast as lightning. Everything was a little bit frightening, but the intensity of the past is gone. Now we're grown up and nothing has any value. That's mm-hmm. the real message of Kung Fu fighting.
Mm-hmm.
We've moved to a post-value time in our lives.
And it's all lost in the past.
The struggle for meaning, and only memory can we revisit these naive notions of greatness.
It maybe says something about my demeanor, but I find that the perfect spot to end.
Make America fight Kung Fu again.
Oh no, don't say no. Do you have any other questions?
I want to do one more.
Yeah.
So in the title poem to your collection, Run the Red Lights, speaker says, my mother looked a little bit like Alex Chilton, lead singer of the Box Tops, and then the greatest rock band of all time, big star in a solo career. Big star? Big fan?
Big fan. And I was always a big fan. And it was our special secret in college
mm-hmm.
to have heard the greatest band ever and for nobody else to know what it is. Everybody else is running around listening to Rush.
Right.
Yeah, and like we've got the true gospel, you know. But then in New Orleans, I saw Alex Chilton all the time.
So
he performed a number of times and I'd see him. But then I would just see him at the grocery store. I'd see him walking down the street.
Mm-hmm.
And that was that was exciting. It was just exciting to be around Alex Chilton.
Was he a sad figure, though? I mean,
no. He's an inspirational figure, right? So he makes all this great music, and then by the time he's 30, he's moved to New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
He sobers up, and he lives like an adult life. He plays in some cover bands. He's an arborist for a while.
Okay.
You know, he lives this life of grace and dignity and peace.
Hmm, that's not
despite,
the way.
I know we have this image of, you know, the Paul Westerberg veneration of
right.
him, you know, this wild figure. But the fact is, by the time he was 30, he was sober and living quietly in an apartment, performing when he wished to.
Okay.
He'd already had all the stardom he really needed.
Sure. That's not the.
And so when I'd see him at the store, he could be doing other things, but this was he was living the life that he wanted to live. You know.
Mm-hmm.
He died tragically because we live in a barbaric nation without health care.
Right.
You know, the title of the book is His Last Words.
Right.
Run the Red Lights. trying to get his wife, who he had a heart attack while mowing his lawn, and waited to go to the hospital till his wife showed up to take him, because he didn't want to waste money on an ambulance.
Right.
You know. Cheerfully, it's been a pleasure talking to you guys.
Yes. It's nice to thank you. K-Boo Studio. Something strange in your neighborhood.